Welcome today. My name is Grant Abbott. I'm doing a series on making moral decisions. This is our second class, and the title of it is What About the Rules, or What Are the Rules? We're going to follow much the same format that we followed yesterday. I'll go over that for those of you who were not here. But we will look more extensively at a kind of moral theory known as deontological ethics, which is represented most especially by the philosopher Immanuel Kant. So there'll probably be more time at the end in which I'm going to be just introducing these things to you. Obviously, we can't do everything in a day. I hope I can just pique your interest enough so that you'll want to study this more fully yourselves. And as I said yesterday, what we're about here really is exercising our moral muscles. And I use the analogy of distance running or distance training. We are here to be able to stretch and extend our moral muscles somewhat, to be able to actually exercise them, and to be able to gain some tips maybe about training. To keep in shape or get in better shape as it comes to making moral decisions. Again, I'm Grant Abbott. I'm an Episcopal priest in the Diocese of Minnesota in St. Paul, Minnesota, next to the Northwestern Theological Seminary. I have no advanced degrees in ethics, but I've done advanced work at the University of Minnesota. It's just that I have an avocation in this and have been the diocesan examiner in ethics and moral theology for the last 7 years, so I keep up in this area. In a sense, I'm just like you. I'm just somebody who got interested in something, and I try to keep up as best I can and try to help my own people in my parish make better moral decisions. What we will do then in terms of format, we're going to be looking at one, two, or three moral dilemmas in which we're going to use the format of the presentation of the dilemma, and then I'm just going to ask questions of you, and we'll get a discussion going about these things to help all of us to see how we already are acting as our own moral philosophers, even when we don't realize what we are doing. And then, after we've had a chance to do that, we want to look at then what have we been doing, and look at that particular aspect of it, which has to do with rules and duty. So in order to do this, I need to do two things. One is to pass out the dilemmas to you, which must be returned at the end of our time, and then also get people's names. So if you could sort of pass these to the back row. And because we are engaged in a sense moral conflict here, I've suggested that we at least mention everybody's name so that we at least get a sense of who we are as we are talking about these issues about which we may very well disagree. So I would like to start here with your name.
Susan.
Barbara.
Barbara.
Margaret.
Juliet.
Who adds there in the macro? Okay, let's get to work here. I'll have to discipline myself to stand somewhere near the mic here. I usually like to roam around, but I've picked out two of these dilemmas in particular to start with, and then I've got a third. We'll see here. It's the second one. A close friend and colleague at work asks you to lunch. At lunch, he tells you that he has AIDS. He's afraid to tell anyone for fear he will lose his job, his insurance, and his apartment. He asks you not to tell anyone. What do you do and why? And this is a simple dilemma right now. It's very bald, but we will begin to give it hair as we go along here and fill in things. But we're just starting now, just on the surface. Who would like to begin?
Just... I wouldn't tell anyone.
Okay. Susan, you wouldn't tell anyone. Why?
Because I think AIDS is so widespread that it's not going to be too much of a threat to anybody.
Okay. So you would respect his wishes and not tell anyone. Okay.
Yes. Well, I wouldn't tell anybody at work, but if he was having sexual relations with someone, then I would.
Okay. So that if he were violating somebody else's trust by not telling them that he had AIDS, even though he was involved sexually with them, then you would feel morally obligated to tell that person. No. Now, why would you feel you ought to do that?
Because then he's a threat to somebody. If he's just working with us, we're not going to catch AIDS from him.
Okay. So it's the fact that he would be harming somebody else that you would then feel obligated to break the commitment not to tell him. Okay? That's great. Okay. Any other permutations about this? Yes, Carol.
I think
not to leave him isolated,
right.
But he needs support.
Right.
A place where he would get anonymous support. He would get support, but he wouldn't be confidential. Let's make this a little bit juicier again, put hair on the dilemma. And let's imagine that this gentleman is a kindergarten teacher. Does that make any difference if he's teaching young children? Why not? Okay.
I think their parents might not be pleased about it.
So you feel that if it were to be known, mm-hmm. then there would be a reaction by the parents and saying, if we had known. Would that be strong enough for you to break the trust, or would you encourage him to tell the parents?
I think I would encourage him to do it. I think it's his responsibility.
What does he do, though, if the school in which he's working or the district in which he's working is not as understanding as you people are about AIDS? And there is a very real chance that he will be fired from his job and let go. And perhaps, as has happened to many, lose their apartment too because landlords aren't paying.
I'm not sure. I keep hearing that it's going to increase. Very big increase of it. I'm wondering what will happen when, say, a large percentage of the population. I mean, everybody's being very careful now about being fair and all this. I don't think it's really scary like the plague.
Any other comments? We've got a kindergarten teacher here who has AIDS. Hi.
Well, I still think it's not contagious. The only thing I was thinking is what happens when he gets sick. Because he should be prepared to give some sort of explanation once he is trying to contact us.
What happens if he's a cook at Burger King? Does that make a difference then? You wouldn't tell on him, but you wouldn't go to that Burger King either, huh? Okay. What do you do now? I have no idea how understanding the Burger King Corporation is about this kind of situation. But he's a cook, he's scared.
Yeah, I don't know what the policy is.
If it's nationally or by state, Jan, do you?
Well, we had a proposition on our ballot in California that would require a testing upon employment when completed, but the margin, I forget the exact percentages, but the margin wasn't that great, you know. So you have a number of people out there who would like to have those requirements.
There are some states that I think include AIDS under the category of diseases like cancer and others for which people cannot be fired from work. But not all states do that. I don't believe that is the present the case. But we're getting into an issue here that's very important. Let me just say this, Holly. Yeah, I'm sorry to interrupt. But we're dealing with the question of the facts. How important the facts are when we are making moral decisions.
Well, I know the danger for nursing in hospitals is that they can come in contact with fluids that they consume. Now, as a cook, if you cut yourself and there's blood that is fluid, that would be bad. So, put him at a job where he's not coming to play. And I think, you know, maybe encourage him to just make sure he's doing it tonight. And I don't think.
That doesn't seem to be a situation. So your suggestion would be, or your hope would be, that an employer would be wise enough to say, look, you know it's dangerous being back in the kitchen with the knives. We'll put you at the counter, okay? Or we'll put you downstairs being our bookkeeper or something like that, if that's feasible. Pardon?
A cashier.
I'm just curious, have any of you had people with AIDS in your congregations?
Yes.
It's been very amazing to me. Most of the congregations that I know of, and recently, the family that I'm staying with in Seattle, my family, the kindergarten teacher there, a man, did get AIDS. And when he told the parents, the response was wonderful. And they've been just incredible. And most of the congregations have been really great. However, there is this issue of fear. They want to tell, they want the support, but they're afraid. If word gets out back to their employer or their insurance company, they're going to get it.
I find it interesting that two cases in our congregation are citing from the state actual people with insurance, and they both almost went out fearless and basically they're scaled to.
Sure. Let me just add one other thing here. Does it matter if this person is a homosexual? Does that make any difference? Okay. But otherwise, it wouldn't make any difference if you were a kindergarten teacher or a Burger King chef. Well, I'm not sure we can assume it, except in just we can assume, because we're playing.
We can do anything. But as I understand it,
case of a prisoner in Minnesota who bit the hand of the guards that were taking him to court. Because it was an yes. We're sensing here that it really makes no difference. I think we all have to understand that we are in a very select group here. This is not the general opinion of American society. Let's get to another one that may be a little closer to home here. Let's go down to number 5. This one's just very simple and straightforward, and some of you have probably confronted this. Your 15-year-old daughter comes to talk with you about drugs. She wants to know if drugs are always wrong. What do you tell her and why? Number 5. And if you don't want it to be your own child, it could be somebody else's child. Somebody's coming to you for advice, maybe, because their child has come to them and wants to know about drugs. And what's so bad about drugs?
They are, because many of them do not know the truth.
Okay.
And for a while, some years back, they became drugs are not harmful. Even though there has been experience to prove so, but the media was not telling. And so this is a myth that has been accepted. And yet, the watchman keeps using that.
Okay, Margaret, what would you tell your daughter? Stay away from
it. And from the people who have to use it, because temptation is difficult. And it's a lot of money. Folks who are around.
Are we talking about legal drugs, prescription drugs? Or?
Okay. I think we're probably, this is just drugs. Yes.
I think when our girls ask us about it, the first call is just give them glad that they're here.
Uh-huh.
And we appreciate what they do. It was in the easier context that they were just commenting about the drugs that they probably were not in school, they were already in.
What if we're just simply here talking about alcohol? Do you drink, Martin, at all? No. Any? Carol? Okay, this is a 15-year-old girl.
Yeah.
It's still her free decision. Once you've provided the education, you want her to make up her own mind as to whether or not she's... Would you say more than just, it's up to you? Would you offer your own opinion?
Yes.
What would you say? What would your opinion be? I mean, would you say, what if she said, let's take marijuana. You know, gosh, kids have, you know, I've been at parties and kids are passing joints around and things, and I'm wondering. She says, if I don't do it, the kids are going to think I'm some kind of a nerd or a geek or something, or I'm some kind of a prude.
It's a very difficult part when everyone you know is doing it. very difficult, even though they may know the education, to education the result. I think many of them still have this.
Let's say now that she's 21 and she's in college. What do you say? Does it change that she's older? Yes. Not only to educate them about the drug, but to educate them about responsible use of the drug and the environment in which the drug is being used. In some cases, it's illegal. So there's a legal consequence, potentially. You are breaking the law when you really do this. Are there some drugs that you would say absolutely not, never, no, don't ever even experiment with it? What might be some of the ones? Angel dust. I think that's changing.
Strong people, you know, after a year or two, change their mind. They say, this is not what I want to do. But it takes a strong person to
do. Okay, we could keep discussing this one longer, but I just want to get that one going. I want to turn now to the back side of the page, to number 11. Your spouse has had Alzheimer's disease for several years now. He's only being maintained by a life support system. Do you have the right to tell the doctors to turn off the life support system or systems? Okay, well, let's add that. Let's say, yes, you've talked it over before. What's the outcome of our conversation?
And that they don't want to be maintained artificially.
Okay.
Then I say definitely.
So then, in a sense, you had a verbal living will. Yeah. Okay. All right. So then it would be okay to terminate the spouse's life in that case.
Maybe not legally.
Okay, it would depend on the state, that's true, there are different laws in different states. But in that case, the violation of the commandment, thou shalt not kill, would be okay. Okay?
How would you consider that, thou shalt not kill? I wouldn't consider that killing. That would just be taking away an artificial thing that if the group wasn't there, if the life support system were there, they wouldn't be there anyway. So that doesn't seem to me, I don't think that's the same as killing, but allowing him to die naturally.
Okay. So that what makes it morally right is that this is an artificial prolongation of life, and death is a natural part of life, and you ought to be able to just, you know, when you want to die, you ought to be able to die.
Yeah, like 20 or 30 years ago, that wouldn't even have been a question. They would have died.
Okay.
Did you make a decision?
someone that's having made a decision to put the person on our consent system.
Yes.
Or making a decision to put them on the consent.
What do you do if you have no control over the decision? Because there are states in which the doctors are required to put people on life support systems. In fact, again in Minnesota, let's make this a little more complicated. There was a case in which a person was maintained on life support systems, and the spouse went in and shot the spouse. Do you think the person is justified in doing that? The doctors were not able to disconnect the life support systems. This person had had Alzheimer's for years and was really in a vegetative state only maintained by the life support systems. And the spouse went in and shot the other spouse. Is that morally justifiable?
I somehow
so that you're saying that maybe this spouse should not have done the killing, but should have gone, which is in fact the case of the father in Chicago who went in and disconnected. Well, he held a gun, I'm guessing, the doctors and nurses, and that's okay. You're saying that's morally okay in this situation. Okay, why do you think why is that okay? People have the right to bring a gun in and hold you at gunpoint in order to... Why do we do that? As a nurse, you can... There are also... But isn't this a part of the Hippocratic Oath, too, for doctors? I mean, you're there to preserve life and not to kill or harm life. And so there's sort of a professional moral obligation to try to keep people alive as long as possible with the hope that maybe somehow something might come along. And sometimes things do happen. I mean, people in comas do sometimes revert. It does happen. Yes,
Well, sometimes I think the line is a little bit fuzzy too. I mean, a lot of the things I thought, speaking of my grandma before she had to take pills all day long. If it hadn't been for those pills, she wouldn't have lived as long as she did. Now, you could say that's artificial too, because 50 years ago, they didn't have any
drugs.
Now, she was getting around just fine, so it wasn't a matter of, it was drastic, but she was being artificially fulfilled.
Remember the Episcopal theologian, lay theologian years ago, William Stringfellow, almost died. But just about that time, they tried out these special drugs on him in which he wasn't able to produce the amino acids or something, and so he had to take tons of these pills all day. But it enabled him to digest enough food. He had to eat something like 8 or 10 times a day. He had to eat every few hours. It kept him alive. And that is, again, artificial, but we benefited from the fact that he was able to write and think. He still had a mind. So we get one of the criteria here is that there's something about the nature of the person that makes a difference here. To lose a limb is not the same thing as to lose one's mind. Quality of life is, and who who then has the right to decide what is quality of life?
A young friend of ours was in an accident which killed his two other friends in the car, and he was brain dead and kept on a life support system, 22 years old. The parents were advised by the doctor that they should pull the plug, and one parent agreed, the other did not. So he was maintained a few more days until she could come to accept the inevitable. Now, in that case, I think it's interesting that you have the doctor saying yes, which is usually not the case, and the parents saying no. I think we need to establish guidelines for, as these cases come up, for every variation, because it becomes increasingly difficult to make decisions that are, you know, at the basis level, costing us millions of dollars, you know, as you pointed out, all of us. And I think that's even true in the United States, because
one last comment here, and then we've got to move on to some other stuff here.
Well, I was just going to say that I think that we have to try to leave as much possibility for choice on the individual system, such as college issues. And I don't think we have the answer. I think my determination similar to abortion is that we have a clearer picture. We just have to let it be an individual agonizing moral.
The public speaker did mention about aiming at death. You have to do an EKG mixture three times to keep the aim. That should be it.
What, Janet?
Again, you look at this, you would satisfy me, so I think it's useful. So there is the half of the public discussion. How hard that is for our officers. And now we have totally eliminated the will to do that document that one. I got one and I thought, well, it's good to just fill out. But I don't know if all other vehicles have set it out. It's pretty expensive. And, but at least that's the cost.
Well, I think we've gotten going here by looking at three different kinds of moral dilemmas that can happen to people every single day. And in discussing these things, we've looked at various aspects of making moral decisions, the importance of the facts, the fact that there are different rules, differing rules that we have, there are consequences to what we do, there are differences of opinion. And maybe in some cases, there isn't an absolute answer. But maybe only the best answer we can give, doing the best we can with the information and the beliefs and the values that we have. What I want to do now is turn our focus to this one particular kind of moral theory that tries to deal with these kinds of things in a particular way. And then on Thursday, we will look at utilitarians, and on Friday, we will look at people who follow Aristotle and Aquinas in the school of the morality of virtue and character. But first, let's just face again the fact that we have moral conflict. And it is not easy to resolve moral decisions. So what can we do? There is a moral philosopher, Tom Beecham, who suggests five things in his introduction to moral philosophy that can help. The number one thing is get the facts and agree on the facts. It's useless to argue when you can't even agree on the facts. And that's part of the problem, maybe with the abortion issue, right? We really don't agree on the facts. And besides our disagreement about other things. So get the facts, and then another thing to do is to see if you can possibly agree on terms. Because you may not be meaning the same thing. People may be equivocating with what they mean by justice, or what they mean by rights, or what they mean by paternalism. and what they mean by liberty. So you need to get some common agreement if you can. And he does suggest C, agree on a common framework of moral principles. I look at this and even the context in which he writes this, yeah, the example he gives is a group of people, a panel that's asked to come together to create some guidelines. I think in the heat of an argument with just other people, that's very difficult to do. I think what happens in community sometimes, when you're sort of thrown together to work things out, as sometimes happens around here, you eventually come to a kind of consensus. Well, we disagree about this, that, and the other, but we can agree about this. We can have sort of these basic principles, rules, or values, and these are they, and the rest is sort of up to your own discretion. But that takes time and a lot of work, and I think, in a sense, I would say creating a kind of community. Then he suggests the use of examples and counterexamples, and you guys were doing that. You know, you're giving specific cases and then saying, well, wait a minute, what about this case over here? So you look at one thing and then you look at another case that isn't quite the same. And then his fifth thing is to expose the inadequacies and the unexpected consequences of an argument. Now, this is difficult to do when you're arguing, to sort of want the other person to educate you about the inadequacies of your own position and the unexpected consequences of your own argument. But that kind of humility, I think, is really important. We have to be willing to be enlightened by those people with whom we disagree. That is not always an easy thing to do, especially when we are convinced that we are right, that they are wrong. But that is really important. Okay. So we've got these differences of opinion. There are many, many different kinds of moral theories. So many, in fact, that some people see ethics and morality as simply a field of relativism. You know, when in Rome, do as the Romans do. You know, it's all up to you. There really is no absolute moral standard. You just sort of, in a particular place, you do that particular thing. If you're in the Kalahari Desert in South Africa, you do one thing. If you're in Polynesia, Tahiti, you do another thing. If you're in the streets of New York City, you do another thing. Okay? And then there are others who say that ethics is just, you know, it's just basically your own personal decision. Well, it's up to each individual subjectively to choose his or her own values and to live up to them. This, of course, would be the existentialist view. And not even, again, saying that these things have to be universalized. It's just sort of developing your own opinion. And then in the middle of this century, from the 30s to the 50s, there was a large, pretty strong school of ethical and moral philosophy that said that ethics is basically no more than feeling, emotion. So good was yay and bad was boo. This is right, yay. This is wrong, boo. And A.J. Ayer, for a while, was a part of that school, thinking that basically moral principles, because they were not really verifiable or falsifiable, were meaningless statements. They were aesthetic statements, in a sense. I prefer it if you don't lie. You know, I think it's a good thing that people don't harm other people. Well, we've gotten beyond that, but there still is a sense of great diversity in how do we choose among these different theories. One of them is a school that is called the School of Deontological Ethics, big name. Deontological Ethics is concerned with the establishment of moral rules by the use of reason, which are acted upon solely for the sake of duty, not because they are going to produce some good end. The idea is that with your reason or your intuition, you come out with certain moral rules that are authoritative. And you say that any reasonable person should agree to these rules, and because I believe any reasonable person should agree to these, I will therefore obey them and follow them, because they are good in and of itself, because reason dictates that they are the rational principles that any rational person should accept. I'm not doing it because I think it's going to produce more good. I'm not doing it because somebody tells me to. I'm not doing it in order to get ahead. I'm not even doing it to please God. I'm doing it just for the sake of the fact that it's good in and of itself. Yes?
What would
be an example of that? Well, what sort of thing would be a duty that wouldn't, and reasonable that wouldn't produce a good end for us? Well, one of the things that, the classic case, of course, is what's called divine command theory, which is basically 10 commandments.
Is that by reason? Is that by reason?
No, they would say, people could say that yes, any reasonable person should accept this, not just on faith, but because these are reasonable things that God says that any person ought to do just for the sake of doing them. Now, this differs somewhat with Kant, and we're going to get to Kant. Kant would say that to do them because God said to do them would make them not moral principles.
Well, you wouldn't arrive at it by reason. You'd arrive at it because God said
to. Right, but you could say, you could take them and say rationally, you know, are these, in fact, rational rules that any person ought to accept? We're going to get to this, to some of those, some of these principles that we as Christians commonly throw around, which I think would satisfy Kant's criteria. Okay, so we have this duty-bound ethics, but the guy who really put this for us is a man named Immanuel Kant, who is, I'm sure all of you know, lived in Germany in the end of the 18th, beginning of the 19th century, one of the major philosophers of Western history. And Kant was a person who did believe in the power of reason. And he wanted to find out a basis for moral action that would be universal and prescriptive and authoritative. That would not be based on the concern about will this bring about good consequences, because who knows if it's going to bring about good consequences or not. And something that would not be simply something where somebody says, I ought to do it because if I do this, hey, you know, good things are going to happen to me if I do this. Or because somebody else is telling me to do it. Now, what Kant decided was an action is right if and only if it conforms to a moral rule that a rational agent would necessarily follow if the agent were acting in accordance with reason. I'll say that again. An action is right if and only if it conforms to a moral rule that a rational agent would necessarily follow if the agent were acting in accordance with reason. Now, that sets up the moral rule, but now he goes a step further and says, an action has moral worth only when performed by an agent who possesses what Kant calls a good will. And a person has a good will only if moral duty, based on a universally valid norm, is the sole motive for action. In other words, a good will is one that wills to do its duty. The duty that reason dictates. Understand? Reason dictates that this rule is something that any rational moral agent would subscribe to. I don't do it for any other reason than simply because I am accepting that. I'm a rational person. I'm doing my duty. I am fulfilling, my, in a sense, my human potential as a rational person. Guided by reason and not by passion and desires and by other things. And in that case, then, you cannot act just in accordance with duty, but for the sake of duty. We're already getting into places of language, I think, which sends up warning signals to us that makes us uneasy, right? There's something about this language that makes me uncomfortable. It sounds cold. Just doing your duty. It sounds dangerous because we've heard of too many people who thought they were doing their duty, right? Well, Kant might have responses to that. We can get into that in a sec. Now, what Kant also does is make a big distinction between autonomy and heteronomy. And autonomy is simply an individual freely choosing rationally to act for the sake of universally valid moral rules. That is autonomy. Freely choosing rationally to act for the sake of universally valid rules. Heteronomy, in a sense, is anything else. If anything else is causing you to make this decision to act in a particular way, then you're acting heteronomously. So if you are acting because you are being forced to do it by some external force, that's not autonomy. If you're acting on it out of your own desires, it feels good, I like it, I want to do it, that is heteronomy. If you are doing it to produce good, that's heteronomy. And if you're doing it to please God, that likewise is not autonomous. And you can see here in Kant the hallmark of part of our liberal faith, the autonomous, rational individual as the hope for the world, who is not distracted by passions that lead us astray, but who is able to put aside passion and dispassionately see what reason dictates and is able to do that. So, Kant's central thesis is that individuals ought to will the acceptance of universally valid moral principles. To do so is to be autonomous. The goal of moral education, then, is to develop such autonomous individuals who also respect the autonomy of others. So we come to respect one another as individuals who have the right to choose our own moral principles. Now, of course, if we're not doing that, that's another matter. And your heteronomy may be my autonomy. Your autonomy may be my heteronomy, and we can get into a little bit of argument about that. Okay, but these distinctions are, it's a very important one, just in the history of philosophy, to know some of this terminology. And then the next terminology becomes very important, because Kant developed what he called the categorical imperative. is provides like a template for deciding if in fact a moral principle is such, a universally valid moral norm. And he gave actually three different versions of this, but two of them are quite similar. So I'll only give one of those and then the second one. Okay? The first one is, I should never act in such a way that I could not also will that my maxim be a universal law. You're in a situation, any one of these dilemmas, thinking about them. Can you will in that situation that what you choose to do become a universal law? In one sense, he calls it actually being a law of nature. I mean, it would have to happen. Everybody would have to follow your rule, no exceptions. Can you do that? If you can do that, then you have the form of a categorical imperative. Categorical because it allows no exceptions, imperative because it tells you what to do. There's a second form, which I find interesting because it seems different to me and different to other people, but I like it anyway. It's one must act to treat every person, as an end, and never as a means only. One must act to treat every person as an end, and never as a means only. So you really cannot simply use people. This perhaps comes out of the respect for the autonomy of the other person. It doesn't say that you cannot use somebody as a means, but just not as a means only. Always treat them as an end. What does that mean? Respecting the other person's interests and wishes and wills, not simply getting for yourself what you need. That does raise questions, doesn't it, about some experimentation, some studies. Maybe you don't tell people exactly what's going on. The guinea pigs. Is that okay? When would it be okay? What would you have to do in a certain situation to not use somebody as just a means, but also as an end in a situation where you have to have sort of a blind study of things in order to get the advantages out of it? What do you do? Now, there's another set of imperatives, but I don't have to write these down, but it's what he calls the hypothetical imperatives. And these are basically for everything else that is means to end reasoning. If I want to get to college, then I better study. If I want to be a good artist, I better spend time doing my sketching exercises. If I want to get to the Olympics, I got to train. If I want to live a long life, I ought to try to live healthily. Those are hypothetical imperatives. But then what then are some examples of categorical imperatives? And I was trying to think myself, and maybe you guys could come up with some. Love your neighbor as yourself. Could that be possibly the form of a categorical imperative? We could will that to be a universal maxim. Anybody think of any exceptions?
What about people who don't love themselves?
Okay. But they would still be commanded to love, that's a good point. Love their neighbor's a good point, that's right. What do you do? I don't know, maybe there's a problem here now.
It's the same problem that you have with the golden rule. You're on
drugs. Right, that was the next one I was going to bring out. Gosh, the Bible isn't doing very well here today. But you get the gist of it. There are a couple of examples that Kant himself uses that have been used against him. So one is always tell the truth. It sounds great until you get to the example of somebody who has run to your house who's being pursued by a crazy murderer, and the person asks at the door, is so-and-so there? Right. Right. Do you always tell the truth? Another one is never commit suicide. But there are ways in which some Kantians have gotten around this and say that perhaps you need to specify the situation more clearly.
What did Kantians say about the assumption he made that you can actually subdue the passion and aspire to a completely rational self? And this is the problem of the Enlightenment. I teach neoclassical literature, and the reason the Romantics rebelled against that notion so completely is that they seem to divorce the head from the heart. And we know that we're positive, those two, and we can't completely, nor is it even desirable to completely subdue
the head. So there is, that's one of the criticisms that's leveled against this kind of project. Other ones are that, is this really free of considering ends and means and consequences? When you look at it, and some people have argued that Kant really does consider consequences in developing these laws. And there are other criticisms. All this does is end up giving us a whole bunch of rules, and how do we know which one to follow? And according to Kant's categorical imperative, if you have two categorical imperatives that are there at the same time in the same action, and even though they conflict each other, you're still supposed to do them. There's a philosopher named W.D. Ross, a British philosopher earlier in the century, who came up with the idea of the difference between prima facie duties and actual duties. So you get a list sort of prima facie duties. If there's no conflict, you ought to do this. But in a given situation, if there's a conflict, then you have to decide which is your actual duty, which is the best balance of right over wrong. Highly intuitive, but it's sort of one of the best, one of the classic examples of trying to get around that. Okay, these, I just want to get you interested in this because there is still a lot of discussion about this kind of thing, and if you get interested in ethics, you sort of have to know about Kant. We don't have enough time. I see we're running out, so I want to be real quick here. If some of you may not be able to be here from now on. This, a fellow named Lewis Smedes, who's a theologian and ethicist at Fuller Seminary, in his little book Choices, comes out really with 5 steps in making moral decisions. And I just want to throw them out to you because, for just basic stuff, without getting too technical, isn't that bad, I don't think. He says, face the facts, respect the rules, consider the consequences, be responsible, trust in the Lord. The last one has to do with it's better to act and be wrong than not to act at all. Face the facts, respect the rules, consider the consequences, be responsible, trust in the Lord. That doesn't tell you here what the rules are, what the consequences are. That's up to you. But I think as sort of a rule of thumb, when you find yourself in a situation, you think, okay, have I got all the facts? What rules do apply here? Let me think. This one. This is, in a sense, using your moral imagination. What might be the consequences? Am I willing to be responsible in this act? Am I willing to accept the credit or the blame? Have I the moral character to stand up for what I have done? Martin Luther King, letter from a Birmingham jail. That kind of standing up for what you believe and taking the consequences. And then as Christians, as religious people who believe in God, a merciful God, then knowing that being wrong is not the worst thing in the world. I'm stopping at this point. We still have more time on the tape. I think what I'm going to do is just turn off the tape right now. If anybody has any other questions, we can keep going. If you have to leave, it is 5 o'clock, so you can leave.